KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Israel now so arrogant, wants to be the hegemon, and it wants now to engineer a new Middle East in its own image.
How does the rest of the Arab world view the conflict between Israel and Iran?
For Tuesday, June 24th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. This hour, how does China fit into the Israel-Iran war?
And an update on the administration's plan to send migrants to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba.
Plus, we'll explain why Republicans are split over a proposal to sell off millions of acres of land that the federal government owns.
There's no fix to start selling our public lands to pay off tax breaks for billionaires. Period.
Later, tips on how to stay cool in a heat dome.
The root cause of a lot of discomfort is a house that is leaky. So one of the key things to look at is where you can seal up the house.
And the president drops an F-bomb.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Speer. A U.S. official not authorized to speak publicly has confirmed a CNN report that based on an early assessment, the massive U.S. air campaign against Iran this past weekend did not obliterate the country's nuclear program, as the Trump administration has claimed, but possibly just set it back a few months. NPR's Tom Bowman reports it's just the latest indication of tension between the White House and the intelligence community.
There is friction between the intelligence community and the White House. The White House, again, wants to say that they've completely been successful in ending Iran's nuclear program, but that appears not to be the case, according to this intelligence assessment. Now, analysts have long said that it's very difficult to completely end a country's nuclear program, because you have the knowledge base there. In Iran's case, you still have some enriched uranium that they could increase to bomb-grade uranium.
Senators were slated to get a classified briefing today, but that's now been postponed till later in the week. President Trump is in the Netherlands attending the NATO summit. It is a short gathering this year. It ends tomorrow, but there are some big debates happening over defense spending by alliance member nations. More from NPR's Deepa Shivaram.
The goal of the summit is to get NATO nations to commit to spending 5% of their GDP on defense in the next decade. But President Trump isn't convinced the U.S. should have to adhere to that number. On the flight over to the Netherlands, he said he doesn't think the U.S. needs to pay what Europe pays. He was also unclear on his commitment to Article 5 of the NATO Charter, the mutual defense agreement that says if one NATO country is attacked, all will defend. Trump said he was committed to, quote, saving lives, and said he'd give an exact definition on his stance on Article 5 when he got to the Netherlands. Nations are meeting for a dinner at the palace of the King of the Netherlands this evening and then gathering for summit sessions on Wednesday. Deepa Shivaram, NPR News, The Hague.
Withering heat in the east today. Temperatures in Boston hit an all-time high for the month of June, reaching 102 degrees. The heat wave comes as the city held its annual opening of a spray pool in the nation's oldest public park. Eve Zuckoff from member station WBUR waded in.
Some 116 million Americans are under heat alerts today. And 11-year-old Antonio Vasquez said he was feeling the high temps.
Like, I was sweating so much, my armpits felt like it was going to come off.
But today, hundreds of children were able to beat the heat at the Frog Pond Spray Pool on Boston Common. Vasquez and his younger brother Josiah splashed under a tall sprinkler and sprayed water at each other.
And I'm so excited. I was just spraying everywhere, and a rainbow just showed up.
The city will remain under a heat emergency through tonight. For NPR News, I'm Eve Zuckoff in Boston.
Stocks crept back toward near record highs today amid hopes a ceasefire between Israel and Iran holds. The Dow was up 507 points. The Nasdaq rose 281. This is NPR. Sean Diddy Combs today praised the judge at his sex trafficking trial, saying he won't be testifying as his lengthy case winds down. The defense rested without calling any witnesses in the case against the hip-hop producer. Combs has pleaded not guilty. The government, meanwhile, called 34 witnesses over a six-week-long presentation. The nation's top safety investigators say multiple failures are to blame for the mid-air door plug blowout during the flight of Alaska Air Boeing 737 MAX jet last year. NPR's Joel Rose reports the National Transportation Safety Board met in Washington to review results.
The chair of the NTSB, Jennifer Homendy, started the meeting by praising the crew of Alaska Airlines Flight 1282, who got all 177 people on board safely back to Portland International Airport after the mid-air blowout. But Homendy faulted Boeing for not having more robust safety procedures in place.
The crew shouldn't have had to be heroes, because this accident never should have happened.
Hammondy also praised Boeing CEO Kelly Ortberg, who took over last year, for renewing the company's focus on safety, but she said there is still more work to do. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
A pair of British bears that escaped from their enclosure at UK Wildlife Park made a beeline for where their food was kept and gobbled up weeks' worth of honey. The bears, Mish and Lucy, also scarfed some snacks before deciding it was time for a nap. Officials in the park in southwestern England say the public was never in any danger. The bears were eventually rounded up and returned to their enclosure, a bit fatter and presumably a bit happier. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington. The ceasefire between Israel and Iran got off to a shaky start. The countries had been at war for 12 days when President Trump announced the pause in fighting last night. Israel hit Iran again soon after that announcement, and Iran struck back, which prompted a furious reply from the U.S. president. Of course, the U.S. is directly involved in this conflict, having bombed nuclear and military sites in Iran over the weekend. Today, the war appears quiet. NPR international correspondent Aya Batraoui is in Dubai, and she's here to explain the status of the conflict. Hi there.
Hi.
Okay, so almost as soon as the ceasefire was announced, Israel seemed to blow right through it. Tell us more about what happened.
Yeah, it was a very shaky, uncertain start. Israel pounded Iran with strikes during a window between when Trump announced the ceasefire and when it was supposed to come into effect this morning. And then Iran hit southern Israel, killing four people there. And then after the ceasefire began, Israel said Iran had fired some missiles. It didn't cause damage, and Iran denies firing anything, but Israel was ramping up to hit even harder when President Trump issued a very rare public rebuke of Israel. He told reporters, "I am not happy with Israel." And then he said, "These two countries don't know what the blank they're doing." And then he posted online a message to Israel in all caps saying, "Do not drop those bombs. If you do, it is a major violation. Bring your pilots home now." And that's when we saw Israeli warplanes bomb an Iranian radar installation and nothing more.
So strong words in public. What about behind the scenes? Can you tell us about the conversations that have been going on among these three countries since the war started?
Like immediately after Israel first launched its attacks on Iran that started this war, countries in the region rushed to condemn the attack. And behind the scenes, there were all these calls from Arab leaders to the U.S., to one another, to Iran's president. There were messages being passed here and a whole full network of back-channel efforts to really try to de-escalate things. And we even saw how that played out just before the ceasefire was announced. So last week, the U.S. started moving aircraft into hardened shelters at its largest base in the Middle East, Al Udeid, in Qatar last week. And then the U.S. bombed Iran's nuclear sites soon after that. And then what we saw when Iran came to respond to that U.S. attack with missiles fired at that same airbase, that Qatar had closed its airspace only hours before. And that also involved back channeling, with Iran giving prior notice and warning about that attack to mitigate fallout.
Interesting. Just taking the long view over the last couple of years, the region has changed so dramatically, with Syria's leader falling, Hezbollah decimated in Lebanon, Hamas being pummeled in Gaza, and now the conflict with Iran. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says his country is reshaping the Middle East for the good of the region. What is the view in Arab states?
You know, Ari, it has changed a lot, but war for particularly Gulf Arab states, especially where I am in the UAE and Dubai, it's never a good thing for any country, but especially here because you've got 10 million people, 9 million or more are foreigners. This place really relies on tourism and investment, foreign workers, and international travel. Now, that said, there was some support for Israel's attacks. I asked Emirati political science professor Abdelkhalik Abdullah about that, and here's what he said.
We had Iran with all these missiles capabilities, drone capabilities. So any weakening of Iran, no matter who does it, whether it's God or a devil or Netanyahu or Trump or whatever, at the end of the day, it's good for the stability of the entire Middle East and the Gulf included.
Now, that's the view of some in the Gulf, but also Abdullah says, and he represents other views also here, that Israel too is wreaking havoc. And he says that goes from the West Bank to Lebanon to Syria and Gaza.
Israel now, so arrogant, wants to be the hegemon, and it wants now to somehow engineer a new Middle East in its own image of a sort. None of that is comforting. None of that is good for the region.
That's NPR's Aya Betraoui in Dubai. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, nearly half of the country is experiencing a heat wave from the lower Mississippi Valley and Midwest all the way to the East Coast. So naturally, people have questions about how to cool down and stay cool. For help navigating this excessive heat, we're joined now by Julia Simon from NPR's Climate Desk. Hi, Julia.
Hey, Elsa.
Okay, so with temperatures in the upper 90s and even triple digits in some places, it can be really hard to stay cool, even with air conditioning inside. So what can we do to keep temperatures low while inside, you think?
Yeah, so first, if your blinds aren't closed, close them. Close those curtains. Don't let the heat of the sun get inside. If you have fans and aren't running them, turn those fans on, ideally right next to you. This is a time to make a salad, not to start baking. Ideally, you're not turning on your stove right now. Definitely not. And also get a wet washcloth. Try a tip my grandmother used in the 1920s. Sleep with a wet sheet.
Yes. I've totally done that.
Oh, I love it. Bonus points if you have a wet sheet and a fan.
Evaporation cooling. Okay, well, I do understand that the majority of American homes have some sort of air conditioning, but it seems like people are nervous about stressing out their ACs in this heat. So any tips there?
Yes, I spoke to Nate Adams in West Virginia about this.
I'm often known as Nate the House Whisperer for taking existing homes and making them much nicer places to live.
You'll hear a lot about setting your AC at this exact temperature compared to the outside air. The reality is every house is different. There's no one answer. Adam says,
in this crazy heat wave, do your best to set it where it's comfortable.
He also says to definitely make sure your filter is clean.
Okay, so let's talk about some long-term solutions here, because heat waves, I mean, they've just become part of summer life due to global warming, right? What are some longer-term solutions for people's homes?
Longer-term, Adam says, think about better sealing up your house. Make sure that hot air outside isn't coming in when you don't want it to. He says oftentimes,
the root cause of a lot of discomfort is a house that is leaky. You've got too many air leaks coming through. So one of the key things to look at is where you can seal up the house.
Adam says, look at what he calls the bowels of the house for leaks, the attic, the basement. You can also think about having shades on the outside of the house so the heat doesn't come in with the sunlight.
Huh, like sunglasses for the house. Okay. All right, we're talking about staying cool inside, but what are like ways you can stay cool outside?
Every year, heat waves send people to the emergency room for heat stroke. So obviously, try your best to stay inside. If you have to go outside, you should be hydrating. Drink more water than you think you need. Wear a hat. There is a way that the military cools down fast. It involves submerging your arms up to the elbow in ice cold water. But really, try to stay inside in dangerous heat like this.
Right. Okay. Well, I know we talk about this all the time. Heat records are being broken more frequently, and we keep hearing, of course, that is connected to climate change. Julia, just remind us, what is that connection?
Scientists say the most intense heat waves would not be possible without human-caused global warming. Last year was the world's hottest year on record. Climate researchers say global warming isn't a whodunit mystery. The primary driver is humans burning planet-heating fossil fuels like oil, gas, and coal. Scientists say we already have scalable solutions that can cut climate pollution, like wind and solar energy combined with large battery systems.
That is Julia Simon from NPR's Climate Desk. Thank you, Julia.
Thank you, Elsa.
President Trump dropped the F-bomb this morning. As cameras rolled, he used the expletive to express frustration with Iran and Israel. It's another norm busted for a norms-busting president. NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith reports.
When President Trump walked out of the White House this morning, he was mad. It looked like the ceasefire between Iran and Israel was crumbling. With Marine One whirring behind him, Trump said Iran and especially Israel needed to cease hostilities after apparently blowing past the agreed-upon deadline. And he punctuated his point with the F word.
We basically have two countries that have been fighting so long and so hard that they don't know what the f*** they're doing. Do you understand that?
Even for Trump, who is known for using coarse language at rallies, this was significant. American presidents just don't say that word on TV. Here's presidential historian Russell Riley.
You know, politics is sometimes a dirty and ugly business, but in no instance do I recall a president openly using this term in a public forum when he knew it was going to get out.
Riley collects presidential oral histories at the University of Virginia. He says there's plenty of salty language used behind closed doors at the White House. Even President Jimmy Carter once admitted to privately saying blank the Shah during his own crisis involving Iran.
His tongue was fairly chaste. One can't say the same thing of President Trump, at least based on his past history.
Back in 2010, then Vice President Joe Biden whispered the F word into President Barack Obama's ear at a celebration of the passage of the Affordable Care Act.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States of America, Barack Obama.
It just so happens they were directly in front of a hot microphone. And the hot mic incident itself became a big deal. Public discourse has gotten coarser since then. And Riley says Trump's utterance is on brand.
And this is a president that has seldom felt bound by the normal constraints of the office. The use of profanity is, typically one of those constraints.
Riley doesn't expect him to apologize. Trump's ability to tell it like he sees it in relatable terms is one of the things his supporters like about him. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BritBox, committed to shaking up people's watch list with British TV, including new original series like Ludwig, starring Peep Show's David Mitchell. Streaming now at BritBox.com/NPR. From Your Part-Time Controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. YPTC.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. A proposal to sell some 3 million acres of public lands might get stripped from President Trump's so-called big, beautiful budget bill. A Senate rules referee has flagged a technical issue with its inclusion, and the fact is, it's not a popular proposal anyway. Joining us now with the latest is NPR's Kirk Sigler in Boise. Hi, Kirk.
Hey, Elsa.
Okay, so with this latest ruling, does this mean the provision authorizing the sale of public lands owned by the federal government is essentially dead?
Still unclear. You know, this provision is being pushed by Utah Republican Mike Lee, mm-hmm. who has said he's planning to revise it to make the sales even more limited. But, you know, Elsa, even if it had needed just a simple majority to pass, that was no guarantee. Several Republican senators, including from here in deep red Idaho, where I'm talking to you from, and next door in Montana, had said they weren't going to support this. But to answer your question, Lee does chair the powerful Senate Natural Resources Committee. So even if it doesn't make it into this big bill, it could be brought back up at any other time.
Okay, well, what was the argument for selling this public land to begin with?
Well, remember, in most Western states, the federal government owns the majority of the land, and Senator Lee wants to sell some of this land adjacent to cities to build affordable housing and some other industrial uses. Affordable housing is badly needed, he says. You know, think of the desert land just at the edge of, say, Salt Lake City or mm-hmm. Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. So in his initial proposal, he called for federal agencies to identify limited lands to possibly sell across 11 Western states. But he curiously left out Montana, where actually the backlash to these public land sales is particularly intense.
Oh, that's interesting. Wait, explain that, because some Western states, I mean, I'm talking about the ones not on the coast here.
Right.
They can be pretty politically conservative, and historically speaking, it's popular to not trust the federal government. So why don't they support turning this public land over?
I mean, I think one way I'd answer that is that things have changed. You know, public lands in the modern West are really woven into kind of everyday life here and the economy, you know, whether it be for hiking, fishing, gathering firewood, even running cattle, logging. People depend on them. And sportsmen's groups that tended to be more conservative have lately crossed over to join liberals to fight for public lands. And there's huge opposition today, even to limited sales like we're seeing, because they think it's going to set a precedent to start selling even more land. Here's Land Tawney with the lobbying group American Hunters and Anglers.
I mean, Mike Lee is talking about revisions because the stove has gotten hot, the fire has gotten hot from all the people that have pushed back against him. But there is no fix to this. There's no fix to start selling our public lands to pay off tax breaks for billionaires, period.
So are the hunting groups claiming victory now?
Well, not really, because they expect these public land sales proposals to keep coming back up. And, you know, yesterday we had another big controversial development with public lands. The Trump administration is planning to reverse this conservation rule that had protected 58 million acres of forest land from road building and logging.
Right. This is the so-called roadless rule, right? Can you tell us more about it and, like, why the administration wants to reverse protections?
Right. This goes back to President Clinton in 2001, just before he left office. He enacted the roadless rule, and industry groups and Republicans for a quarter century now have been fighting it. There's been over a dozen lawsuits. They've said it locked these areas up and created de facto wilderness, which only Congress can actually designate. So yesterday, President Trump's Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins made this announcement speaking to Western governors in New Mexico.
This misguided rule prohibits the Forest Service from thinning and cutting trees to prevent wildfires. And when fires start, the rule limits our firefighters' access to quickly put them out.
And Elsa, environmentalists are expected to sue if and when this rule formally gets reversed.
That is NPR's Kirk Sigler. Thank you, Kirk.
You're welcome.
Let's hear now about one country not in the Middle East that's closely following whether the ceasefire announced by the U.S. between Israel and Iran holds. China is the largest importer of Iranian oil and a close political partner of Iran's. NPR's Emily Fang reports.
In the days after Israel's first strikes on Iran earlier this month, these panicked videos from Chinese citizens stuck in Tehran, Iran's capital, proliferated on Chinese social media. This Chinese traveler blogging under the name Tiger Living in Pingyang says, with the help of a lot of Iranian people, we have managed to escape. China says it's evacuated more than 3,000 of its citizens from Iran, many of them working for Chinese oil and energy companies. China and Iran are close partners. Iran's one of the few countries which allows Chinese tourists visa-free entry. And including at a press conference this week, China's foreign ministry spokesperson Guo Jiaquan has repeatedly singled out Israel, quote, in particular for what China calls a dangerous precedent of bombing Iran's nuclear facilities. Plus, China buys a lot of Iranian crude oil, despite American sanctions.
China has always been the biggest buyer.
Mu Yu Xu is a senior analyst at commodities research firm Kepler, and she uses satellite data to track oil tankers.
From the moment the vessels approach the oil terminals, loaded, track all the way until it reached to the ports in China.
All to figure out just how much Iranian oil China buys under the table, which over the last year is more than 90% of Iran's oil exports. The oil is transported to China by what Elizabeth Brah, a fellow at the nonpartisan think tank the Atlantic Council, calls a dark fleet of ships.
It's simply vessels that sail outside the official shipping system. They are often aging vessels that have owners that are very hard to identify.
Then, after labeling the oil as coming from Malaysia or Oman, she says the crude is then brought to small private refineries in China. They get the Iranian oil at a discount,
because not that many countries were willing to buy.
But the biggest reason behind this trade is to financially prop up Iran's current regime.
The reason that it buys it from Iran is to make sure that the Islamic Republic can survive.
Saeed Rasaminijan is a senior advisor on Iran at the neoconservative U.S. think tank Foundation for Defense of Democracies.
Before 1979, Iran was a key partner of the United States in the region. Right now, it's important for China that Iran does not go back to that.
China does not have a global military, meaning it does not have the capacity to send military might to Iran. But U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio acknowledged Beijing's political leverage over Tehran in this Fox News interview.
Well, I encourage the Chinese government in Beijing to call them about that, because they heavily depend on the Straits of Hormuz for their oil.
The Strait of Hormuz, through which a lot of Gulf oil is transported. But China has some options. It actually buys more oil from Russia right now. It could also turn to oil-rich Venezuela or West Africa. All that would cost China billions of dollars more a year. Here's Mu Yu Xu again from Kepler.
It's going to be a tricky situation for everybody.
Tricky, but not impossible. Plus, for the last half year, China has been stockpiling oil.
That's the record high based on our data.
Xu says China has more than 1 billion barrels in stock, more than 70 days worth, buying them some time to wait out whatever happens over the next few weeks in the Middle East. Emily Fang, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.
Who is the supreme leader who guides Iran?
He actually has much more control than an American president, in the sense that he also has control over the media. He has control over the judiciary, the legislature.
And what did Ayatollah Ali Khamenei reveal with his response to a U.S. attack? The latest on the Mideast war on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Thank you.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Coming up, an auction in Paris takes you into the world of Napoleon Bonaparte.
My quest in this adventure was to transform this amazing collection into an emotional experience.
The sale even includes one of the general's famous hats.
Now the newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Duane Brown. President Trump is in the Netherlands tonight, attending his first NATO summit of his second term. A key priority for Trump is pushing the military alliance to formalize a commitment to increasing its defense spending from 2 to 5% of their gross domestic product. Trump, speaking to reporters on Air Force One, was asked whether he's committed to the mutual defense clause in the NATO treaty known as Article 5 that says an attack on one member is considered an attack on all.
Depends on your definition. There's numerous definitions of Article 5. You know that, right? But I'm committed to being their friends. You know, I've become friends with many of those leaders, and I'm committed to helping them.
What do you want the role of NATO to be going forward once these other countries are spending more?
By having a unified system, I think we're going to have stronger peace, better peace.
NATO allies are expected to endorse spending 5% of GDP on their security. Prosecutors rested their case against Sean Diddy Combs today. Within a few hours, Combs' defense lawyers rested their case, too. NPR's Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento has more.
Federal prosecutors spent more than 6 weeks laying out their case against Combs. The rapper and entrepreneur faces charges for sex trafficking, racketeering conspiracy, and transportation for prostitution. Lawyers for Combs presented his defense in a little less than 30 minutes. After Combs declined to testify, his team did not call any witnesses. Instead, they presented evidence. First, they read a series of text messages in which Cassie Ventura, one of the women accusing Combs of sexually trafficking her, repeatedly told the mogul how much she loved him and how happy she was in their relationship. Then, defense lawyers pointed out inconsistencies in the testimony of several government witnesses and rested their case. Closing arguments begin Thursday. Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento, NPR News.
And you're listening to NPR. Civil liberties groups plan to challenge a Texas law that would require the display of the Ten Commandments in all public school classrooms. From Houston Public Media, Andrew Snyder reports these are some of the same groups that recently won against a similar law in Louisiana.
Supporters say the commandments are the basis of U.S. law and should be posted in schools. But a federal appeals court ruled last week that Louisiana's similar law is unconstitutional. Rachel Lazar, who heads Americans United for Separation of Church and State, says the Texas law is too.
There are limits on the free exercise of religion. In other words, the government cannot favor one set of religious views over any others or religion over non-religion.
Americans United is a financial supporter of NPR. Lazar says her group and others are also considering suing Texas over another new law, which would let school districts set aside time for students and faculty to pray or read religious scripture. For NPR News, I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
The National Weather Service says New York hit 100 degrees at midday as large sections of the country bake under an extreme heat wave. Nearly 40 cities from the east to the Midwest and south broke record high temperatures for June yesterday, and dozens more were expected today as the heat wave peaks. On Wall Street, stocks finished higher across the board. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station And from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at raymondjames.com. From Amazon Business, offering business buying services, from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington. It's been several months since the Trump administration said it would send up to 30,000 migrants to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. At the time, skeptics of that plan said it would be too expensive and logistically complicated to pull off. So how many migrants have been sent there since that January announcement? NPR's Sasha Pfeiffer has an update.
The first hint that Guantanamo might not be an easy place to house large number of migrants came when President Trump said this on January 29th.
We have 30,000 beds in Guantanamo to detain the worst criminal illegal aliens threatening the American people. Some of them are so bad we don't even trust the countries to hold them.
But the U.S. has nowhere near that number of detention beds at Guantanamo. That's according to Vince Warren of the Center for Constitutional Rights, which gets reports on conditions at Gitmo from migrants who've been detained there.
There haven't been 30,000 beds in decades. The facility is decrepit. It's been falling apart. It's in disrepair.
So after Trump's announcement, the U.S. military began putting up tents at Guantanamo to hold migrants. But since then, some of the tents have been removed. As for how many have actually housed migrants, here's Democratic New York Congressman Jerry Nadler.
Thus far, the tents have never been used.
He was speaking at a House Judiciary Committee in late April.
Instead, the Trump administration has detained a grand total of 400 migrants in the base's hard side facilities.
By hard side facilities, he means existing buildings, including dorm-like rooms. Since his comments, the number of migrants sent to and from Guantanamo has increased to about 500, according to a court filing this month. And usually only a few dozen migrants are held there at a time. The bill for that, Nadler said, is
costing American taxpayers over $40 million. Where is Elon Musk when you really need him? Talk about inefficient. Talk about a waste of taxpayer money.
I sent the Department of Homeland Security a list of 13 questions about its migrant operation at Guantanamo and got a brief reply email that said, this story is fake news. But a congressional delegation that toured Guantanamo in March has supplied some details. One delegate was Democratic Michigan Senator Gary Peters. Here he is at a congressional hearing in May.
On the day that I visited, there were 87 people in custody. And my understanding is that's a pretty normal number.
He and other delegates were told Guantanamo can hold only about 200 migrants at any given point. They typically stay on the island for just a short period.
When we fly them down there, we keep them there a while, then we fly them back to the United States. I think that's kind of outrageous.
The Trump administration said in a court filing this month that it's using Guantanamo for, quote, staging for final removal. But it has not explained why it can't deport migrants directly from the U.S. to their final destinations, or why it's briefly sending some migrants to Guantanamo only to return them to the U.S. ACLU attorney Lee Gelernt has a theory.
There's no question they're trying to scare immigrants. They're trying to keep Guantanamo stuck in people's minds, and immigrants are scared that they may get sent there.
He has sued to stop the government from sending migrants to Guantanamo, which he thinks is meant to frighten them into self-deporting.
It's probably pretty effective. I mean, we're starting to see people give up for fear of being sent to Guantanamo, or sent to El Salvador, or sent to other places. They're giving up and they're going back to countries where they fled.
That pleases another member of Congress who recently toured Guantanamo, Republican Mike Collins of Georgia. In comments posted on his Instagram account, he said the cost of sending migrants to Guantanamo is worth every dollar.
No matter what it's going to take, we need to make sure that we spend it so that we get President Trump's mission accomplished, and that's securing our border and taking our country back. You know, next time I go down there, I want to make sure that I see that place full of those criminals heading out of our country and heading home.
But whether Guantanamo is prepared to hold anywhere close to 30,000 migrants continues to appear doubtful, just as skeptics predicted when the plan was unveiled. Sasha Pfeiffer, NPR News.
Thank you. Some call him a genius and a statesman. Others say he was a tyrant. Napoleon Bonaparte died 204 years ago, and now Sotheby's is auctioning off some of the general-turned-emperor's belongings in Paris. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports.
My name is Pierre-Jean Chalençon. I am a French collector.
Chalençon has been obsessed with Napoleon since childhood. 114 items from his vast collection will go on the auction block Wednesday.
It's a self-made man. I like Napoleon because he's like Rockefeller, he's like Getty. I start to collect, I was 14 years old. Now it's 44 years.
Chalençon's collection is open to the public here at Sotheby's in Paris, part of a modern pop art exhibit with soundtrack. Artistic designer Jean-Charles de Castelbajac created it.
I love to electrify the history. I love to give the future to the past. And my quest in this adventure was to transform this amazing collection into an emotional experience.
There's one of Napoleon's rings, large diamonds encircle a big capital N, and his red velvet travel throne with another giant N stitched in gold thread. One of the emperor's iconic bicorn hats will be up for bid. He wore the two-point felt chapeau sideways so his men could distinguish his horseback profile through the smoke of the battlefield, says Chalençon.
Napoleon was a designer a little bit, and he wanted to be unique. And all of his generals was wearing the hat completely differently. It's why Napoleon decided to have a very simple hat, no plumes, nothing.
You can also bid for Napoleon's fancy fold-up camp bed. Chalençon says it's from his last battle at Waterloo when Europe's armies came together to defeat the French emperor once and for all.
Is it the same mattress?
Yes. No, no, it's perfect. And you see, you have his last shirt, his last underwear, his cravat in silk.
Last worn by the defeated emperor on the island of St. Helena in the South Atlantic, where he died in exile. The exhibit traces Napoleon's rise to his decline with some astonishing curios. Castelbajac shows me one of Napoleon's sleeves.
It's a sleeve of his jacket. Suddenly, a waiter drop some sauce on his sleeve, so they have to take off the sleeve during the dinner to bring it to clean, but they never give him back.
Castelbajac created Instagrammable scenes to attract the new generation of collectors. He says Napoleon was a great communicator.
He will have used Instagram all the time, from Austerlitz, from St. Helens, to say, hey, I will come back.
16-year-old high schooler Roman Bouchonnet is digging the exhibit.
It's very great. In other museums, they are all behind glasses, but here you can really get up close.
Bouchonnet says some consider Napoleon a warmonger, but Napoleon also gave France its civil and penal code.
Napoleon is a perfect example of how most historical figures are not black or white.
Sotheby's is hoping to make upwards of $7 million from the sale of this imperfect historical icon's most personal belongings. The bidding for his bicorn hat starts at just over $500,000. That sleeve, with stain, will start at a bit over 20,000. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. The nation's top safety investigators say multiple failures are to blame for the mid-air blowout during the flight of an Alaska Airlines Boeing 737 MAX jet last year. Members of the National Transportation Safety Board met in Washington today to review the results of a lengthy investigation into the accident. NTSB Board Chair Jennifer Homendy praised the crew of the flight for getting all 177 people on board safely back to Portland International Airport. But Homendy faulted Boeing and regulators at the Federal Aviation Administration.
The crew shouldn't have had to be heroes because this accident never should have happened. The safety deficiencies that led to this accident should have been evident to Boeing and to the FAA.
NPR's transportation correspondent Joel Rose has been following this, and he's here in the studio. Hey, Joel.
Hey, Ari.
It's been nearly a year and a half since the accident. Remind us how it went down.
Yeah, Alaska Airlines Flight 1282 took off from Portland on its way to California. About 6 minutes later, a large piece of the fuselage known as a door plug panel blew out of the aircraft. The cabin was instantly depressurized. Loose items like phones and bags were sucked out of the plane, which was now flying with a large hole in the fuselage. We found out today that there were 3 lap-held infants on board at the time and 4 unaccompanied minor children, including 1 6-year-old who had never flown before. But remarkably, no one was killed or even seriously injured. The crew was able to turn the plane around and make an emergency landing back in Portland. Luckily, the plane was only at about 15,000 feet when all of this happened. If it had been at its regular cruising altitude of 35,000 feet, it could have turned out very differently.
That sounds absolutely terrifying. Have federal investigators been able to figure out exactly what went wrong?
There is still some mystery here. Investigators had said that 4 key bolts were missing when the jet left Boeing's factory in Renton, Washington. We heard today that if even one of those bolts had been in place, it could have possibly prevented the blowout. Investigators say Boeing has no record of exactly who was responsible for removing and reinstalling the door plug. And investigators say they have not been able to pinpoint exactly who performed those tasks. But NTSB Chair Jennifer Hambendie said this points to bigger problems with Boeing's safety protocols.
Like what? What are the bigger problems?
Well, Hambendie criticized Boeing for relying on a single point of failure instead of having a more robust safety system that would have flagged the problem before it left the factory. Hambendie also criticized regulators at the FAA for not being more proactive in their oversight before this incident. And one other interesting takeaway from the meeting today, it just underscored the lack of experience among the factory workers who were building these planes. We knew that Boeing had lost a lot of experienced people during the COVID-19 pandemic and struggled to replace that institutional knowledge. Investigators say there were 24 workers on the door team at this factory, but only one of them had previous experience removing and replacing a door plug panel, and he was out on vacation when this work was done.
Well, have Boeing and federal regulators taken any steps in response to the door plug problem?
Yes. The FAA says it has fundamentally changed how it oversees Boeing. In a statement, the agency said it has capped production of the 737 MAX at 38 jets per month and that it will keep that cap in place until regulators are satisfied that Boeing has improved its quality control. The door plug blowout also sparked a crisis at Boeing. The former CEO stepped down. The company announced a host of changes, including more robust training for new employees. Boeing now has a new CEO, Kelly Ortberg, who took over last summer. And NTSB Chair Hambendie praised Ortberg today for renewing the company's focus on safety, though she says there is still more to do.
NPR's Joel Rose, thank you.
You're welcome.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. President Trump says after U.S. and Israeli attacks on Iran's nuclear program, now it is time for peace. Analysts say there's a possibility Iran moved its uranium stockpiles before the U.S. sent in bunker-busting bombs. And dealing with all of that requires diplomacy at a time when few have trust in talks, as NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
President Trump calls his military strike magnificent and says the last thing on Iran's mind now is its nuclear program.
They're not going to have enrichment and they're not going to have a nuclear weapon, and they know that. They're going to get on to being a great trading nation. You know, they're very good traders.
Iran has been signaling that it wants to contain tensions, giving Qatar a heads up before striking a U.S. base there on Tuesday. But Suzanne DiMaggio of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace says this uneasy truce is not sustainable.
Telegraphing strikes in the hopes of preventing an escalatory spiral is dangerous, magical thinking. There's no way out of this without a diplomatic initiative.
DiMaggio has been involved in what's called Track 2 diplomacy, unofficial dealings with Iran and other countries to promote negotiations. While President Trump says U.S. strikes destroyed Iran's nuclear program, she says there are indications that Iran moved parts of it.
We don't know exactly where Iran's nuclear material is or where their advanced centrifuges are. They've apparently been moved. So this does give Iran some leverage at the negotiating table that it didn't have prior to the U.S. strikes.
Some Israeli lawmakers are sounding the alarm about that. Knesset member Avigdor Lieberman, an Iran hardliner, posted on social media that there is nothing more dangerous than leaving a wounded lion. That's how he referred to Iran. And he said instead of an unconditional surrender, as Trump initially demanded, the world has entered into, quote, difficult and tedious negotiations with the Ayatollah. At one point this week, Trump seemed to be embracing Israel's hopes for regime change in Iran, though he's now backing away from that. Nuclear nonproliferation expert Kelsey Davenport says regime change may not resolve the problem.
In a case of regime change, if Iran is weakened, if it feels that it's facing external threats, a new government might be more likely to make the decision to develop nuclear weapons in order to deter, you know, future attacks or territorial aggression.
Davenport is with the Arms Control Association and supports nuclear diplomacy. So does Sarah Hagdusti, who runs a group called Win Without War. She points out that Trump withdrew from President Obama's nuclear deal in the first term, and this time around, he used the prospect of diplomacy to divert attention away from the B-2 bombers headed to Iran. She says that damages U.S. credibility.
The key reason that people come to tables is to avoid war. And if that is not something that the United States can guarantee, it fundamentally undermines our position in the world.
The Gulf states seem to be trying to step into this breach. It was Qatar that helped Trump arrange a shaky truce. Davenport of the Arms Control Association says countries in the region have an interest in keeping things calm. And the nuclear landscape there is changing, too.
Saudi Arabia has its plans to advance the civil nuclear program. The United Arab Emirates already has an established program. There are opportunities for collaborative nuclear activities that would add transparency into Iran's program, reduce proliferation risk.
But that requires tricky diplomacy at a time when there's little trust by all sides. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
South Africa's Springboks are the number one ranked rugby team in the world. And the country's cricket team just won a world championship that's held by the International Cricket Council every 2 years. Both teams have black captains. And as Kate Bartlett reports from Johannesburg, their successes have united fans in a country that's still grappling with the legacy of racial division.
This month, South Africa's cricket team, led by their first black captain, stunned fans by winning the ICC World Test Championship in London, defeating Australia. South African cricket fans celebrated their victory at London's iconic Lord's Cricket Ground. They're dancing and singing Shosholoza, a traditional song in the Ndebele and Zulu languages. and they have a new hero. Team captain Themba Bavuma grew up in the impoverished township of Langa outside Cape Town. Against the odds, he rose to become the first black captain of South Africa's cricket team, the Proteas, in 2023. 5 years earlier, Siya Kolisi took the title as the first black captain of South Africa's Springboks rugby team. Kolisi and Bavuma are inspiring a new generation of black children to take up the sports, says South African sports journalist Keenan Hemmensby.
It's made people believe, it's made young boys from every community believe that they can make it.
But it wasn't always this way. Cricket and rugby were introduced to South Africa by colonizers, and during apartheid, multiracial teams were banned. The all-white teams were seen by many black people as symbols of oppression and were sanctioned internationally. South Africa's first black president, Nelson Mandela, did more than anyone to change that 30 years ago today. Mandela stunned the country by famously donning the Springbok rugby team's green and gold jersey as the team won the 1995 World Cup, just a year after the first democratic elections ended white minority rule. Later, Mandela gave this speech.
Sport has the power to change the world. It has the power to inspire. It has the power to unite people in a way that little us does.
Fast forward 30 years and rugby and cricket now have multiracial teams that are supported by South Africans of all colours.
Siya Kolisi has been instrumental. I think he didn't have a lot of support initially. People, especially white South Africans, constantly saying he wasn't good enough.
But the Springbok captain has proved them wrong.
That has helped race relations to a large extent. He is a symbol of hope because of what he's done and what he's achieved.
And now, Bavuma is too. South Africans celebrated on social media using the anti-racist hashtags Stronger Together and No DNA, Just RSA. RSA is short for the Republic of South Africa. Large crowds of all races gathered at the Johannesburg to greet the returning players. Sports Minister Gayton McKenzie couldn't contain his excitement.
South Africa is the best sporting nation in the world, and you better believe that.
One of the Proteas, Vian Mulder, said Mandela would be incredibly proud of the, quote, diverse team. For NPR News, I'm Kate Bartlett in Johannesburg.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Mathnasium. Whether students are ahead of the curve or need extra support, Mathnasium's goal is to build confidence through personalized math instruction. Learn more at mathnasium.com. From the Kresge Foundation. Established 100 years ago, the Kresge Foundation works to expand equity and opportunity in cities across America. A century of impact, a future of opportunity. More at kresge.org. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits, at progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. And from the John D. and Catherine